We left Jonah almost in the middle of the air between the ship and the sea. We're picking up the story after he's been thrown into the sea. Verse 17 of chapter 1. And the Lord appointed a great fish to swallow up Jonah. And Jonah was in the belly of the fish 3 days and 3 nights. Then Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the belly of the fish, saying, I called to the Lord out of my distress, and he answered me. Out of the belly of Sheol I cried, and thou didst hear my voice. For thou didst cast me into the deep, into the heart of the seas, and the flood was round about me. All thy waves and thy billows passed over me. Then I said, I am cast out from thy presence. How shall I again look upon thy holy temple? The waters closed in over me, the deep was round about me, weeds were wrapped about my head at the roots of the mountains. I went down to the land whose bars closed upon me forever. Yet thou didst bring up my life from the pit, O Lord my God. When my soul fainted within me, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to thee into thy holy temple. Those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their true loyalty, but I with the voice of thanksgiving will sacrifice to thee. What I have vowed I will pay. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. And the Lord spoke to the fish, and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. There is a minor storm in America over censorship of television. And the storm was started just a few days ago by a comedy show which so many felt went over the border of good taste, and so many were the objections that in fact the comedy show has been withdrawn. And the item which caused the offense was a sermon on Jonah, in which the comedian thought this really was a subject to make fun of, and he began by propounding the theory that the great fish was in fact a guppy. You need to understand something of tropical fish to see the humor in that remark, and he went on from there. Interesting that this should happen this very week after last Sunday I told you that nowadays people think Jonah's good for a joke and very little else. Can I put it this way? While the Bible says that the whale swallowed Jonah, or a great fish did, it's quite obvious that many people cannot swallow Jonah today. And there is a stop in our minds about a story like this. Indeed, some people see in these 2 pages out of 1,300 in a whole Bible the one proof that this book is not the Word of God. There are those who say, you expect me to believe that a God of truth can produce a book containing a story like that. That's just more than I can swallow. I can't take it. And the poor little book of Jonah has been the test ground for a man's faith. And people have said, you don't still believe that. Not only is the Word of God at stake by questioning Jonah, but God himself is at stake. There are statements here about God. Are they true? Is God this kind of a God? Is God a God who can control the fish, as well as the weather, as well as the worm in the last chapter? Is God this kind of God? And what is really at stake is not just this book, not just the Word of God, it is God himself who is at stake. Now, I begin at a very mundane level by asking 2 questions. Could a whale or a great fish swallow a man? Secondly, has it ever happened within known history, apart from the Bible? Take first the question, could a whale swallow a man? Now, we all know that whales are air-breathing mammals. They are very close to men in that regard, almost unique among the creatures of the great deep. Dolphins and porpoises, I believe, share this honor. But the whale is a mammal. It belongs to the same species of air-breathing creatures as we are supposed to. So there are already links. And there is no doubt about it, though, that as some have said, the whales that are caught for your margarine are in fact, however big, are too small in their throats to swallow a man. And this is true. The Arctic whale could not swallow a man. It lives on minute creatures in the sea, which it filters out from the water, and its throat just could not take a human body. But then the Arctic whale is never found in the Mediterranean. Do you remember we're talking about the Mediterranean? The whale that is found in the Mediterranean is the sperm whale or the cachalot. And this, in fact, has a much larger throat, a throat quite big enough to swallow. Furthermore, its eating habits are these. It swallows up a lot of seawater and a lot of creatures in it through the large throat, and then immediately something inside its throat sorts out the food from the water. The water is expelled straight away and the food passes on to the tummy. But the entrance to the tummy is too small for a human body. Between the throat and the tummy is a large pouch called the laryngeal pouch. And this is the main center of the breathing. Food passes straight through this pouch. If it's small enough, it goes on into the tummy. If it's too large, it sticks there. And it is here that the air is taken in. And it is perfectly feasible for a man to survive within that pouch for some time. He would, of course, be without food, but for some days he could certainly survive. So in theory, at any rate, it is possible if, for example, this great fish were a sperm whale. Doesn't state that it was. There may be other creatures that could do this, but at least we know of at least one that could. But the second question, has it ever happened? Well, there are two cases within recorded history of such a thing happening. The first was in 1758, and the details are not very well authenticated. It's there. There is an account. The full details are not given, so we're not able to check up. But there is one from the year 1927, which is certainly attested by a Mr. Ambrose Wilson. You can look it up in your public library if you wish. It happened off the Falkland Islands. A whale overturned a boat in which a number of sailors were after the whale, trying to harpoon it. And in fact, the whale swallowed one of the sailors. 3 days later, they opened up this whale, having caught it, on the deck of the whaling ship, and to their utter astonishment, found this man doubled up in this pouch. And found, to their even greater astonishment, that he came round, and that he did recover. His health was not in too good a state for the rest of his life, and one remarkable thing, which will come up later in our study, I think, was that his skin was bleached a dead white color by the juices, the gastric juices, to which his body had been exposed, and it remained that way for the rest of his life. Well, now, what does all this say? It simply says that Jonah didn't have a monopoly of this bizarre experience. But it doesn't yet deal with the miracle. The real miracle is not whether this could or did happen. The real miracle is that God made it happen at just the right moment. Jonah didn't have to swim around till 1927 in the hope that it would happen. And the statistical odds against it happening at the right time in the right place are so immense that I think anybody will realize the real miracle is in the words, "And God prepared a great fish." This was not a chance accident, as it was in both the other cases. It was a deliberate, planned event. Having said all that, I think we must be careful to let the Bible speak for itself and to see what it does say and what it does not say about this unusual event, lest we create unnecessary difficulties for ourselves and say that things are in the Bible that are not. I give you an illustration of this. For example, there is a widespread idea that Eve gave Adam an apple. You'll never find that anywhere in the Bible. There is a widespread idea that three kings came from the east to visit the baby Jesus at Bethlehem. You'll not find that anywhere in the Bible. And there is this idea that Jonah was swallowed by a whale, but in fact that's not in the Bible at all. A great fish, yes. It doesn't say what species it was, and in fact, we can't know what it was because nobody ever saw it. Except poor old Jonah from the inside, and you don't get a very good idea of what species you've come across from that vantage point. The other thing I want to say that is even more serious is this. It seems to me quite clear from the language of chapter 2, when studied carefully with an open mind, that at some point in this experience, Jonah died. And that the miracle we are studying is not a miracle of survival, but a miracle of resurrection. And when we look closely at the language involved, you'll realize why I say that. At some point in the experience, Jonah died. Now let's begin to look at the Bible itself and ask, what does it say? Most of our study tonight is the study of a prayer. And a most amazing prayer. And considering the circumstances in which it was offered to God, it's a prayer that should command our close study and attention. Some scholars have told us that this prayer shows that the book of Jonah is the concoction of a committee. Because this prayer is made up of parts of 11 different psalms. And you can check up the psalms. For example, Psalm 18, Psalm 31, Psalm 42, Psalm 69, Psalm 142. These are all quoted in the prayer. And so some scholar got the bright idea of saying that somebody has just concocted the whole story. He's wanted to construct a prayer, and so he's pulled little texts from here and there, put them together, and here is Jonah's prayer. There is a much simpler explanation than that, and it's this. When you are really praying, when you're really in distress, when you're praying from the heart, you will discover that phrases and snatches of readings and hymns come naturally to your lips. If you have been a regular worshipper of God, if you've regularly joined in worship with God's people, prayed and praised as they have done, some of the hymns that you have sung will come back to you in moments of distress and you will sing them to yourselves. This is a perfectly normal experience. The fact that you use other people's words in a prayer does not make it less of a prayer. It makes it more of a prayer because their experience and yours are being offered together. And what they have said about life is true for you too. May I commend to you the practice of reading a psalm every day for yourself. You'll find again and again it expresses just what you want to say. Now, Jonah was a man who loved to go to the temple. We know that from the prayer. He loved to go every Sabbath and worship God with his people and sing the hymns and sing the prayers. No wonder then, when he's in this situation, he finds himself recalling words from the services that he used to attend. But let us look at this prayer a little more carefully. Some of the tenses of the verb puzzle people. In this prayer, he is talking about a deliverance that is already past, and yet he is still in the belly of the whale. Here's a real problem. He says, I called to the Lord, not I am calling, I called, past tense, to the Lord, and he answered me. He further says, later in the prayer, thou didst bring up my life. You have saved me already, and here he is still in the whale. Now, how do we explain this? Some people say it is because this was related later by Jonah. He is telling someone about it, and he's saying later, now, this is what I prayed. And so, as always, when you're telling about a vivid experience and reliving it as you tell it to someone else, the tenses of your verbs change. But I think there's a much more obvious explanation for it than that, to be found within the prayer itself. When was Jonah delivered by God? When was he saved? The answer is not when he came out of the whale, but when he went into it. And when we grasp that, the prayer just falls into place and everything he says in that prayer becomes meaningful. God saved him when he went into the whale and not when he came out of it. Now, I get that from the prayer itself. And you know, it's quite astonishing how many people have views on Jonah who've never studied the book properly and who've never really looked at this prayer and never studied its wording, which is very important. When we do, we discover this, that our usual conception of what really happened is probably based on our own imagination. Now, I remember as a boy when I heard this story, I saw a picture. Here was the boat. Here were the sailors, 1, 2, 3, and over he goes, and in midair is Jonah, and then popping out of the sea is a large head with a big open mouth. I'm sure you've seen this kind of picture in your mouth and drawn it by a Sunday school scholar, and there is Jonah, plop. But you know, this is not what happened. We can tell from the prayer what did happen. And what did happen was that Jonah was drowned. Before ever the fish appears, the sailors never saw it. Before ever it did anything at all, a great deal happened. The language is vivid. It is the language of a drowning man. It's the language of a man who believes the end has come. They tell us that drowning men see their whole life in a flash. I don't think that could possibly be true. But as I think it was Dr. Johnson once said, it could have a wonderful power of concentrating a man's thoughts. And certainly one or two key thoughts would come into his mind. And true to life, it happens here. Now notice the language. He talks first of being cast into the deep. And there he is floundering. Probably he couldn't swim because the Jews hated the sea and very few of them could swim. And he is conscious of being thrown into the deep, into the heart of the seas. And as he is thrown, he says, the flood is round about me. He's conscious only of water all around him. And then the waves and the billows pass over him. But his head just keeps popping up as a wave and a billow passes over him. And then he says, the waters closed in over me. All this is happening so quickly that it's almost so quick, too quick to write down. And it's in a series of phrases. The waters closed in over me. The deep was round about me. And as he sank through the waters, his hair got caught up in some seaweed. You notice the phrase, weeds were wrapped about my head. And the word he uses is seaweed. In the original language, the seaweed was round his head. At the roots of the mountains, he was conscious of being among the rocks at the bottom of the sea. That was about his last thought. And as he sank down to the bottom of the seabed, however deep or shallow it was, I wouldn't know. It was fairly near land. Land was in sight because they rowed hard to reach it. But he sank down to the roots of the mountains where they go straight down into the Mediterranean Sea, and there, caught in the seaweed, his last moment of consciousness comes. Now, in between this description of being thrown into the water, the waves crashing over him, but managing to struggle up again and then becoming weaker and sinking and going down in the sea, he describes the thoughts of his mind as he went. There are not many, there wouldn't be time, but there are one or two. Very important thoughts. One is, I shall never see the temple again. For the first time it comes home to him that the temple is part of his past. He used to love to go there. He'd been running away from it when the sailors took him to Tarshish. Now he knows he will never again worship in that place and sing praises to God. I suppose when he ran away to Tarshish, he had an idea that in a few years' time, after it had all blown over in heaven, he might come back and worship again and sneak in at the back unnoticed. Now he realizes he never will again. I am cast out from thy presence. How shall I again look upon thy holy temple? That was one thought as he went down. Another thought was that he was going to die. He wasn't just going down into the water. He was going down to the land whose bars close over you forever. He describes that place as Sheol, Hades. as the pit. And these are all phrases that we were talking about this morning. The realm of the departed, those who've died. He knows perfectly well he's dying. And he prays from the realm of the dead. The first prayer he offers on board boat, he wasn't praying. The sailors were praying like mad and they said, why don't you pray to your God? He knew it was no use. Now in his drowning moments, he's face to face with truth. And the prayer for salvation comes from the world of the dead. Out of the belly of Sheol, I cried. He died. And his spirit prayed to God. It's the only case in the Bible of a prayer from the dead being answered. And it's the prayer from a servant of God. And this prayer was offered before he entered the whale. It was in the distress of drowning and in the disembodied state of separation of spirit and body that that produced, that from the belly of Sheol, from the dead, Jonah cried. Now he knew from the Psalms that even if you go to Sheol, you're not beneath or beyond the reach of God. If I ascend into heaven, says the Psalm 139, behold, thou art there. If I make my bed in Sheol, if I die and go down to the dead, you're there too. You can reach me there. Wherever I go on earth, there's only one place you can go to that God can't reach you, and that's hell. But hell, as we saw this morning, is quite different from Sheol or Hades. In the world of the departed, God can reach his hand. He has the keys of death and Hades, so has Christ. And so the prayer came first from the belly of Sheol. Now at that point, and only at that point and not before, with a dead body lying among the seaweed at the roots of the mountains, at that point God answers the prayer of a dead man. Brings him back to life in a most unusual way. That great fish comes. Let it be a sperm whale. We can't be dogmatic, but it seems as if that was likely. And it picks him up. Now you may say that's a profoundly unnatural thing to do. There are some people here tonight from the church I was at formerly in Chalfont St. Peter, and they will know somebody called Dave Brown. And they will have seen with me a film which he brought back to his home church where he was a boy about 5 years ago, I think. And he is now the trainer for Marineland in California, training whales and porpoises to do tricks. You've seen them on the television. And he showed us a film that he had shot of his pets there. And one of the sequences in that film, I found a most remarkable sequence. A whale and a porpoise shared a huge tank together, rather larger than this church. And they did all their tricks for the spectators. Being mammals, they're highly intelligent. Probably the most intelligent of the fish. And one day the porpoise died and sank to the bottom of the tank. And the whale was terribly upset. Dave Brown took films of what happened next. The whale came swimming down to the bottom of the tank, picked up the porpoise in its mouth, swam back up to the top, and for 3 days tried to get it to breathe again by pushing it through the surface of the water. Isn't that amazing? Never forgotten that film. I could see old Jonah being pushed up again there. This deep instinct for air, for life. That's precisely what happened at this point. Only it didn't happen naturally or by instinct. It happened because God was in charge of the situation. The whale took up Jonah, and it seems that at that point, through a miracle of resurrection, not survival, God gave him his life back and brought body and spirit together, and as we've seen, he would be able to survive those 3 days and three nights. Now he prays about something that has already happened, a deliverance he has already had. He now knows when he came to, realizing that he was in some living creature, that something incredible had happened. that God had not accepted his resignation as a prophet, that God had not let him go, that God was still going to deal with him, that God had literally heard that dying prayer and indeed that dead prayer from the belly of Sheol, and spirit and body had come together. It's not the only resurrection in the Old Testament. There are two or three others. There are more in the New. When body and soul are brought together by God again. And so here he is alive. No wonder he speaks in the past tense. I cried, he says, out of the belly of Sheol. I was dead, drowned. And God reached down there and he answered me, and here I am. I was thrown into the deep. The waves and the billows crashed over my head, but I popped up again. Then the waters closed over me, and down I went into the seaweed and the roots of the mountains. You can see it all. And he thought he'd never see the temple again. Now, in the wail, he realizes he will. Now there is a tremendous note of hope. Thou didst bring up my life from the pit. My life. You've brought it back again, O Lord my God. And now he realizes he's going to get a chance to go back and pick up the threads and start all over again. And he finishes the prayer with a tremendous shout of triumph. Deliverance belongs to the Lord. Now, how could he shout that when he was still in the whale? The answer is precisely because he was. He'd taken a single ticket to Tarshish, and God had the return trip all arranged. 3 days and three nights were needed to get back to Joppa. Now, the most important thing about this prayer, and the most significant from beginning to end of it, is this. Here is a man who turned to God in the worst extremity of his life. You notice that he accepts God's justice completely. He doesn't blame the sailors for throwing him in the water. He said, Thou didst cast me into the deep. He doesn't blame the sea for drowning him. He said, Thy waves and thy billows went over me. He acknowledges absolutely that he deserved to die, that it was just, but he cried to God for mercy. It's great when a man says, I deserve to die, but I plead for life. I deserve your justice, but I ask for mercy. I deserve the worst you can give to me, but I ask for something of the best. When a man does that and prays like that, God answers. When a man recognizes the justice and the mercy of God together, God listens and does something. So he prays to God. Can you notice this? Most people pray to God when they're in a jam. Most drowning men do. Talk to sailors in the Navy who've been near drowning. They'll tell you they'll pray. Somebody said to me this week, I've really prayed in my life twice. And they told me of two very deep experiences and dangerous experiences during the First and Second World War when twice in their life they really prayed. Now, the difference between Jonah and that person would be that Jonah didn't just pray when he was in a jam. And here is a little word of advice that somebody once gave me. It's a profound word. Get your anchor down before the storm begins. The man who can pray most effectively when he's in a crisis is the man who's prayed before. And Jonah's prayer reveals that he has the right idea of God, and he knows the right way to pray when he's in the crisis because he's been praying regularly in the temple. And I want you to notice further that Jonah says, and when I'm out of all this, I will pray again. I will offer sacrifices of thanksgiving in that temple when I get back. And he says this now, what I have vowed, I will pay. What is he referring to? There was a day years and years ago when Jonah as a young man was called of God to be a preacher. And Jonah vowed a vow that day and said, God, I'll be a preacher. I'll go anywhere you want me to go. I'll speak to anybody you want me to speak to. Here I am. I vow my life. I offer it to you. And he's broken that vow by going to Tarshish. Now he says, God, I'll go back and I'll pick up the threads of that vow and I'll do what you've told me to now. I may be speaking to someone tonight who years ago was called to be a missionary, called to be a minister, called to be a preacher, called to be a Sunday school teacher, and who's run away from that call. It would be very wonderful if some crisis in your life brought you to the point where you said, what I have vowed, I will pay. So many of us when we were young Christians said, Lord, we want to do anything you want us to do. We'll go where you want us to go. We'll speak to whom you want us to speak. And now we've settled for middle-aged Christianity when we don't. When I was young, I set my goal as far as I could see. But now I'm nearer to my goal. I've moved it nearer me. That sums up a lot of Christians. What I have vowed, I will pay. He now sees the point of going to Nineveh because in his prayer he says, verse 8, I can now see that those who pay regard to vain idols forsake their true loyalty. In other words, I know now why you wanted me to be a missionary. I know why you wanted me to preach. Because people who don't know the truth have forsaken their true loyalty to God. They worship vain idols. And so it's all coming back. Here's a man being called again to the mission field. I suppose the most wonderful thing about this story is this, that God is so patient with us that he'll have us back again. God could have called any other prophet, any other man or woman on earth to go to Nineveh and preach in place of Jonah. God could have called another, but he didn't. He said, Jonah, I still want you. You've let me down, you've betrayed me, you've run away from this, but I still want you. And if you've been a Christian for many years, you've known the patience of God like this. When God has called you back and said, I still want you. I know you've let me down, but I want you back again to go on doing this for me. Marvelous grace of God. So we've gone through the prayer. I must come now to the final verse. And the Lord spoke to the fish and it vomited out Jonah upon the dry land. Came right in shore to do so. I'm going to tell you a rather funny little thing now. The children's Bible is a lovely Bible. It's on the bookstall at 30 shillings. Wonderful value. And that's the commercial. There's a delightful story of Jonah here. And the picture of the whale just pushing off into the distance. Can you see it? Jonah left standing on the shore and Joppa in the distance. And there's the whale going. It's a delightful illustration. My younger daughter studied that for a long, long time. And then looked up at me and in all seriousness said, where's the sick? And she was very anxious that someone had not been true to the details. I use that out of the mouths of babes and sucklings, but I use it for this reason. Her little mind as a child was saying, there's something wrong with the picture. It's not true to the Bible. She's not the only person to feel that way. And that artist is not the only artist to do that kind of thing, or the only scholar or preacher to do it. I'm trying to be utterly true to every detail of the story. And when you do, it becomes a most wonderful story. I do not know where this happened. Whales can certainly come inshore and they can certainly regurgitate. I don't know where it happened. I would guess not far from Joppa. God has his way of bringing you back to where you went wrong. God has his way of saying, back to square one now, start out again in the right way. God has his lovely way of bringing you back to the place you lost your confidence to regain it. And now you notice that Jonah's exit from the whale was once again commanded by God. You notice that God can speak to fish. God spoke to the fish. And there was Jonah. I've no doubt that his flesh was bleached. I've no doubt that people asked him why it was. I've no doubt that he told everybody who would listen, do you know what happened to me? I ran away from God and do you know how he brought me back? And I can imagine people saying to him, even in those days when they believed more than people believe today, do you expect us to believe that? Do you expect us to swallow such an incredible story? Never. Now it was Jesus Christ himself who was once approached by a group of people who said to him, give us some sign, give us something to see, give us some miracle that will prove to us you're the Son of God. And Jesus said, I'll tell you what. He said, as Jonah was 3 days and 3 nights out of sight, out of mind, entombed in the deep, I will be buried in the heart of the earth 3 days and 3 nights. And as he came out of that whale, I'm expanding here, but I'm sure this is what is meant. As he came out of that whale with the marks of the death upon him, so I will come out of the tomb. And as the resurrection of Jonah was the sign to the city of Nineveh, my resurrection will be the sign to the whole world. But, and here Jesus added something elsewhere, he said, even if someone rises from the dead, people don't believe. And I'm afraid that's true. Jesus called himself a greater than Jonah. Jonah rose up from the grave. He rose up from death. He rose up from that drowned corpse at the bottom of the Mediterranean. And he rose up from that tomb of the belly of the whale. Jonah had been dead and buried, and Jonah rose up, and a whole city believed that it was true and accepted his story. Jesus, the greater than Jonah, rose up from the tomb. And there are people today who, in the face of, I think, incontrovertible evidence, deny that Jesus is alive today. There is a parallel. Both deaths were due to the justice of God. Both deaths were, in a sense, judicial murders, executions. In both cases, God raised from the dead. In the one case, the death was a man for his own sins. In the other case, the Son of God for everybody else's. Both deaths and resurrections of Jonah and Jesus led to the good news of God's love and mercy being taken to the Gentiles. And next Sunday evening we'll continue the story with chapter 3.